Hello. Good morning. And thank you for coming to this special event. And I'm very happy and honored to introduce to you our North American Tibetan representative, Mr. Pemba Singla. And last more than 25 years, you know, Mr. Pemba Singla has served wholeheartedly Tibetan government and very much respected by Tibetans all over the world. So, and I requested Mr. Pemba Singla to give some talk on Tibetan issue and concern. So, any without further ado, so I would like to welcome Mr. Pemba Singla, a Tibetan representative of North America. Thank you.
Is it working?
Yes.
Hello, check. Yeah. Ah.
Number one.
Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah. I can use this.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's fine. So who are going to be seated here? Thank you, Gisela, for the introduction and the opportunity for me to meet all of you. Normally you listen to Gisela on Buddhist teachings, and today it will be a little different. Of course, I represent His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the Central Tibetan Administration in North America, and I came at a very interesting time last August, so it has been almost 6 months that I came here and got to watch everything what was happening in the United States, including Washington, D.C., and we are still watching, trying to find out where it's going to settle down. It was still early times, so now the overall thinking of His Holiness, I'm sure you all are very familiar. His Holiness always says that He, being one among the 7 billion people in this world, it's His duty to promote universal values. And He, being a Buddhist, one among the different religions in the world that caters to people with different mental disposition, He promotes interreligious harmony, respect for all religions, respect for all religious leaders. And then He, being a Tibetan, He has to work for the issue of Tibet. So these are His three commitments overall, so I don't need to expand on what this means. I'm sure you're all very familiar with that. And then, in the course of His Holiness' relationship with the international community, over the last 30 years, His Holiness has been working with scientists, particularly on psychology, neurology, and quantum physics, because these are certain areas that the ancient Indian wisdom, the Nalanda tradition of Buddhism that came into Tibet, are in a view viewed as far, far ahead of modern science. And now there has been quite a number of mind and life conferences, and any of you who are interested in attending that, the next conference will be held in October in Montreal this year. Then, of course, His Holiness has now divided Buddhism into three parts. One is Buddhism for Buddhist practitioners, including rituals. One is the philosophy of Buddhism, and the other is Buddhist science. So His Holiness says, even if a person does not believe in particular religion, even an atheist can study Tibetan Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist science. And I think now we are in the process of translating the abstracts of all this Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist science, which has been composed into two books and released already in Tibetan language. that will be translated into some 8-10 different languages and will be distributed around the world, so people will have access to study Buddhist philosophy and Buddhist science. Now, one of the major focus of His Holiness is that, of course, the world is ridden with troubles, particularly from the younger generation, and His Holiness believes that something is definitely not complete in providing modern education. So modern education caters only to material benefit, individualism, and that is causing a lot of problems. So His Holiness has now over many years been trying to promote what is sometimes called as secular ethics, but I'm to understand that the word secular is not well received in the United States. In India, when we say secular, it's respect for all religions. So secular ethics, or if you don't work like the word secular, then you can call it universal ethics. Then if you want to make it more complex, then it's emotional plus 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 studies. So these are, and the Emory University, I was just there in Emory last the few days back, and Emory University is in the process of developing a curriculum along with I think the University of British Columbia, who has a very good well-developed training on emotions and those kind of things, secular ethics and those kind of things. They are going to work very closely to develop a curriculum to teach ethics in schools up to the university level. So once that is done, if as many schools in the United States, as many schools and colleges in the United States can adopt that, and the rest of the world will also look up to it and maybe adopt it from the practices that are successful in the United States. And that is something that His Holiness really looks forward to. So they will be a visit of His Holiness to Emory this October. Particularly focusing on this particular topic. Last June, when His Holiness visited the United States, he made it a point to speak at the Conference of Mayors in Indiana to speak about this particular thing and also ask the mayors to adopt including a curriculum of teaching ethics in ethics not particularly related to one religion, ethics that are taught in all religions. So that should be even appealing to the atheist who don't believe in religion. So that these are the areas that His Holiness is working on right now. And then I want to focus a little more about, since you are all learning Tibetan Buddhism, then maybe a little bit about the situation inside Tibet and how are the Tibetans organized themselves around the world, and how big or how little resources we have, so that you can think of helping us in future. So how many have you been in Tibet? Two. Dan, of course. How many times there? Only one? Only once. That was how many years back? 8 years back. You don't look that old.
He was a very little boy.
Yeah. And how many have been to India or Dharamsala? That's okay. A little more. So just to give you a brief overview of, because some people think Tibet is a very small place. How big do you think Tibet is? Compared to U.S. in percentage.
Isn't the question of greater Tibet and the Tibet now?
For us, Tibet is one. China makes it greater Tibet and Tibet Autonomous Region and all that. For us, Tibet is one geographical area that is contiguously inhabited by Tibetan people, traditionally inhabited by Tibetan people. So if you say Greater Tibet, including Greater Tibet, what you would do? What is the size of America in square kilometers? Now this is a huge geography lesson. United States is, in terms of, I don't know about square miles, but in terms of square kilometers, it's about 9.8 million square kilometers, United States. And China is 9.7 million square kilometers. And Tibet, so China is a little less than U.S. And Tibet is 2.13 million square kilometers. So that's about 23% of China's total landmass, but inhabited by only 6 million Tibetans. So we call ourselves the land of cool clime, Pu Sinenjong, or land surrounded by snow mountains. That's also there in the prayers. Kangri Rawe Kowe Shinghamjong. So land, Tibet is on the southern border, you know, Himalayas, then the western Karakoram and northern Kunlun and other mountain ranges. So it's all mountain ranges. Tibet is surrounded by mountain ranges, so we call Tibet as land surrounded by snow mountains. And then western missionaries started coming to Tibet, and Christian missionaries called Tibet as the last frontier. There's territory, even how do you call it? The landscape itself is not easy. You know, you can understand not many Tibetans have been able to come out of Tibet, and not many people have gone into Tibet, because you have to climb so many mountains and rivers and mountains and valleys. You know, it's not easy. When the Christian missionaries started coming to Tibet, then they called Tibet as the roof of the world because of its altitude. So Tibet's altitude is about 14,000 feet above sea level, average altitude. So the biggest one are more than 18,000, you know, the Himalayas and all that. Then Asians called Tibet as the fountain of Asian rivers, or some call Tibet as the water tower of Asia. And today, Chinese environmental scientists call Tibet as, any guesses? The third pole. So what are the other poles? North Pole and South Pole. So North Pole, South Pole and Tibet Pole. They call Tibet as the third pole, because Tibet has the largest amount of glaciers and permafrost that feeds all these rivers that goes into India, Pakistan, into Nepal, into India, Bangladesh, into Burma, into Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, and into China. So both the two big rivers, the Yangtze and the Yalu, originate from Tibet. So some say that, of course there are different estimates, but some say one-third of the world population has something or the other to do with rivers that originate from Tibet. Because the places that I mentioned, Pakistan, India, China, you know, Burma, Laos, Cambodia, Thailand, Vietnam, these are all some of the most densely populated areas in the world. So sometimes I say today we are political refugees, but another few decades down the line, if you don't have a good water sharing agreement with the Chinese government, there may be so many environmental refugees, because the downstream countries are really suffering now. And the next world war could happen because of water, because water is becoming more and more scarce and more polluted. 50% of China's river system is polluted. So did you have a good idea of how Tibet, you have a good imagination of what Tibet sounds like now? Okay, so this is how I try to describe Tibet geographically, in terms of location, altitude, and all that. So historically, Now, Tibet was independent. You know, Tibetan language came from India. Tibetan Buddhism also came from India, not from China, even though Buddhism went to China in 2nd, 3rd century AD, and it came to Tibet only in 7th century. We did not take Buddhism from China. We took it from its root, India. So culturally, we are much, much more closer to India than China. So there was never ever a war between India and China till Communist Party of China occupied Tibet in 1959. And there was the first war between India and China in the whole history in 1962. So, of course, for every country there is history, there are influences of neighbors over each other. But Tibet has never ever been directly administered by any other country. So China's claim on Tibet, China says today China's position is Tibet has been a part of China since antiquity. Now when is that antiquity? So sometimes they say 7th century when Tibetan king was married to a Tibetan king took a consort from China, and then the Tibetan king also had a wife from Nepal. So in that case, Nepal can also claim Tibet. You know, but the question is, at that time, Tibet was more powerful than China. That the Chinese princess had to be given in marriage to the Tibetan emperor. You know. Then they say 13th century when Sakyas ruled Tibet. But there we had a very special relationship, the priest-patron relationship. So we turned the warrior-like Mongols. Even today we joke with the Mongols, you know. At one time, starting from Genghis Khan and all the Khans that followed him ruled more half of the world. And even today there is a huge intellectual debate inside China as to who is a real Chinese. Whether it's a Han Chinese or Tibetan are Chinese or Mongolian Chinese. If Mongolians are Chinese, then China can claim half of the world because Mongolians conquered half of the world. Yeah. So Mongols had influence over Tibet 2 years before Chinese Empire. You know, so history, 1642 and 46, something like that. So 17th century. Now, they are not able to prove that. So when we have talk about negotiation and dialogue, China always says, oh, Dalai Lama should say that Tibet was an inalienable or is an inalienable part of China. This is one of the preconditions. So what His Holiness the Dalai Lama says is, I am not a historian. So let us leave history to historians. So there is the Chinese propagandist history of Tibet. There is a Tibetan version of Tibetan history, who are the real owners of Tibet. And then you also have unbiased or, you know, researched history of Tibet by Western scholars. So if you look at all of it, you will understand, or you can do your own studies and write Tibetan history. So His Holiness says that history is history. We are not disputing, we cannot change history. We cannot rewrite history. You know, but what is more important is that we look towards the future. So whether we like it or not, Tibet and China have been neighbors since this earth came into being. So we can't lift Tibet out and put it somewhere in the Atlantic or Pacific. So we are neighbors, you know. So as neighbors, we have to learn to live together peacefully. So history, there is the concern from the Chinese government as to the legitimacy of their rule over Tibet. So that's why they are asking history, the Dalai Lama, to say that Tibet wasn't part of, you know. So there is one part. So history part is one thing. Then since 1951, when the so-called 17 point agreement was forced upon the Tibetans to sign under duress, we tried to live under the 17 point agreement for 8 long years. Then Chinese trampled on each of the provisions of the 17 point agreement, and that finally led for His Holiness the Dalai Lama and some 80,000-85,000 Tibetans to flee walking over the Himalayas into India in 1959. So since then to now, even earlier than 1959, the places where he comes from, like Kamedia, or where my father comes from, or where His Holiness comes from, which you are talking about the Greater Tibet part, there have already been a lot of destructions. You may have listened to Geshe Sangpo's life history. If you have not, maybe you should ask him to recount his life history some other day. Not today, otherwise he'll eat my time. So, yeah, there are a lot of, I think, personal stories. There are some other Tibetans here who also have their own personal stories, you know, of how much they suffered under the communist China. So it's not just Tibetans. It's also a lot of Chinese who suffered. And then there are a lot of Uyghurs and Mongols and Manchus who suffered under communist China. And even now they are suffering. That's the problem. We are not seeing an end to the sufferings. So Chinese policy towards the Tibetans, Mongols, Uyghurs, Manchus, all the minority population or nationalities, is the policy of assimilation. So the Chinese, as more and more Chinese move out. So sometimes I give this analogy, the Chinese national flag is a national flag that has no definition, official definition, but sometimes they define it in explaining communism. But if I look at it this way, there are five stars on the Chinese national flag, and one is a little bit bigger. So if you say the big star is Han Chinese, and the four small stars are Manchus, Mongols, Uyghurs, and Tibetans, now in Manchuria, you hardly find even elderly people speaking Manchu language. So along with their language, their culture, and everything is gone. Now in Inner Mongolia, what China calls as Inner Mongolia, but they themselves like to be called as Southern Mongolians, now they are only 16% in what China designated as Inner Mongolia. The rest are all Han Chinese and Turks. So they are a huge minority. Their cause is almost gone. So maybe it's time to remove two stars from the Chinese national flag. The next is Uyghur and Tibet. Now in Tibet, starting from capital Lhasa to all the major towns and cities, it's Han Chinese majority. So within the Tibetan community, we sometimes argue about, you know, whether we should seek independence or autonomy under the middle way approach proposed by His Holiness. I said this is a total waste of time now. Another 30, 40 years down the line, if we are not able to go back to Tibet, forget about independence. Even autonomy may not make sense because Tibet will be completely overwhelmed by a majority Han Chinese population. So just like, I'm not trying to blame you, but what happened in America for the Red Indians? Now if you look back into history, what the whites did to the Indians, it's really pathetic. And we should accept history of America. So same thing is being repeated by China over the minority nationalities inside Tibet. So we have now the identity of, or the crisis of identity, crisis of surviving our identity. That is the reason why I say we don't have time. It's not because Tibet is going to run away or somewhere, you know, Chinese are going to run away, but the fact that the number of Chinese that are moving into Tibet at a very accelerated rate. You know, since 2007, now they've linked Tibet, you know, they built this railway from Kormo to Lhasa, which people thought would be technologically impossible to build railway tracks on that altitude over permafrost, sometimes goes up by 4 or 5 meters at different, you know, weather conditions. But they did it. And if you go to Tibet today, you will find highways and roads like what you find in America. The road systems are improving. More airports are coming up. But is it for the Tibetans? Definitely no. So the Chinese government's view is that to resolve any kind of conflicts, Development is the answer. Only material side. 60 years of Tibet occupation, they have never ever tried to understand people's aspiration, what is going on in the mind. So that is why you still have Tibetans who are very, very strong-willed and strong-spirited in keeping their identity alive, and you witness 146 cases of self-immolations, burning themselves to death, not hurting one single Chinese civilian or military in the process, just burning themselves, hoping against hope that the Chinese government would pay some attention to the Tibetan plight or the international community will intervene in the Tibetan issue, which is not happening. You know. So that is the larger picture, assimilation, bring in more and more Han Chinese. So I tell some of our Western friends, just like you find Chinatowns in your country, a few decades down the line, you might find Tibet towns in Tibet completely overwhelmed by Han Chinese population. Of course, we are not against development. Development is good. But it should also mean for the local population. We are not against multiculturalism. It's happening everywhere. Movement of people, it's a natural process. Throughout history, whether you have borders or not, whether you have visa or not, people will keep moving. But it has to happen naturally, not state-controlled, like Tibetan nomads are now being moved into compact communities under state-engineered programs where people lose their traditional way of life, they don't learn new ways of life. You know, it creates a lot of problems, not just social and economic problems, but also environmental problems, because Tibetans have centuries-old wisdom of having lived on that plateau in complete harmony with nature. But Tibetans are not being involved as stakeholders in preserving those grasslands. Yeah, so the serious issues of grasslands being, degraded and eventually desertification. According to a UNDP report in 2006, they said 37,000 hectares of land in Qinghai province alone are being degraded every year, which will eventually lead to desertification. And people are already talking about more than 25% of China's landmass being deserted, you know, being turning into deserts. So there's serious environmental issues. And because of Tibet's altitude, the jet streams that flow over the Tibetan plateau has a lot of climatic influence over the whole neighborhood, not just in Asia. You know, the monsoon in India are decided by the weather conditions in Tibet. And ice and permafrost are melting twice the speed than in any other region around the world in Tibet. So we request governments to, you know, send their environmental scientists to work closely with Chinese environmental scientists to make sure that Tibetan plateau is preserved for the larger benefit of humanity, not only for the Tibetans. Well, Tibet, maybe some view it only as a political issue, but I think more than political issue, there's the larger environmental issue that is involved. And political freedom, you say long live Dalai Lama, you go to jail. You raise Tibetan national flag, you go to jail. You put up a poster, you paste a poster, you go to jail. You sing a Tibetan patriotic song, you go to jail. You write a patriotic book, you go to jail. So anybody who has some influence over the community is targeted. Yeah. And these days, if you take a picture of a person self-immolating and if you post it on a blog or website or wherever, you go to jail. And then religious freedom. There is severe restriction now on the movement of monks and nuns. You just can't, those days in Tibet, people from our region, we go to Lhasa, study and go back to your region and preach and learn. These days, you are not allowed to go. You now recently you are talking about all this, the biggest monastery, Buddhist monastery in the world, in Larungar. More than 10,000 monks. We don't know the exact number. Some say 20,000, some say more than 10,000, but it's definitely more than 10,000. So it's now being reduced to 5,000 residents. And the rest, their residences are being destroyed, they are sent back to their native places, pledging never ever to come back to this monastery or join any other monastery in their local areas. And they are made to dance and sing praises in praise of, you know, the Communist Party. The communist leaders are atheists. They don't believe in religion. But today, their posters, they impose the posters of the communist leaders to be put along with the altars of the Tibetan deities, Buddhist deities in the monasteries. So how ironic can it be? But China is full of contradictions and irony right now. Everything they call, whatever irony comes with it, they always call it with Chinese characteristics. Now the Chinese government is appointing bishops. You know about that? That's Christianity with Chinese characteristics. So they want to be now finally responsible for the, they want to be the final authority to be responsible for recognition of reincarnated lamas. So they have a long list of living Buddhas, what they call as living Buddhas, the reincarnated lamas. His Holiness the 14th Dalai Lama is not in the list. But they want to be responsible for the reincarnation of the 15th Dalai Lama. Just as they did with the Panchen Lama. They have not learned their lesson. With the Panchen Lama, the one appointed by China is not respected by the Tibetans. When he goes to Tibet to teach, the government has to give money to the local population to go and listen to him. And he lives in Beijing, not in the traditional seat of Shigetse, Tashilumbu Monastery. And if you go to Lhasa on the streets, you won't find the picture of the Panchen Lama appointed by the Chinese government. You will find pictures of the previous Panchen Lama on the sale. So that is the level of acceptance or non-acceptance being shown by Tibetans in even very simple, normal forms. You know. So His Holiness says, if Chinese government is really serious about being the final authority in recognizing reincarnated lamas, then they should study Buddhism first. If you don't understand Buddhism, you won't understand the whole process and, you know, of that selection thing. And then His Holiness always makes a lot of fun, so jokingly says, if they are really serious, they should look for Mao Zedong's reincarnation first. Then Deng Xiaoping. Then maybe Dalai Lama's. Is it funny? Yeah. So, these are just a very rough overview of the situation inside Tibet. So what we are trying to do is, you know, in here at the Hill, we are trying to move a bill with the help of our friends in the House and the Senate called the Reciprocal Access to Tibet Bill. So if you as friends of Tibet can write to your or call your members to support this bill, what it essentially says is that any Chinese government leader, journalist, diplomat, citizen can come to the United States with a visa and visit any parts of the United States. But for you as Americans to go to China, you obtain a Chinese visa, and if you want to go to Tibet, then again you need a special permit. You don't have equal reciprocity. Because reciprocity is the foundation of diplomatic relations between countries. Even for Tibetan Americans, for them, if they want to go to Tibet, they face discriminatory processes. Yeah, so these kind of things. So there are some areas that you can sit at home and help Tibetans, not necessarily go on the street and, you know, shout and take placards and all that. So. So that is where Tibet lies right now. Even in 21st century, you don't have... in the other regions like Qinghai and Sichuan, Gansu, these areas a little more accessible, but Tibet Autonomous Region, very difficult. Now, as late as December last year, when His Holiness was to give Kalachakra teachings in January in Bodh Gaya, Many Tibetans came over in Nepal and India to wanting to listen to His Holiness for the Kala Chakra, but then they were denied access to the Dalai Lama because Chinese government asked them to return before December end or face consequences. So face consequences meaning not just yourself who went to India, but your whole family. So many went back before listening to Kala Chakra but had audience with His Holiness. And some stayed back. And those who stayed back and went back to Tibet once they reached back, I think many of them, their passports were torn in front of them. Yeah. So this is the situation. Then, how are we organized in exile? So those of you who have been to Dharamsala, you know there is the mixed Indian-Tibetan community called Maklot Ganj, and there are some school institutions, cultural institutions, educational institutions, and then there is the place where His Holiness resides. And little down, a mile away from there, is the Central Tibetan Administration. We call it the Kanjeng Kishong. So that is not even a quarter square kilometer down there. And from there, we reach out to Tibetans and Tibet supporters all around the world. So His Holiness was very keen that we adopt democratic polity at a very young age. His Holiness went to China in 1954. He saw how communist government functioned. 1956, His Holiness was in India. Even though it was nascent democracy in India, he saw how Indian democracy functioned, even though it was quite chaotic in the parliament. At least people had the freedom to speak, and he witnessed that. So he was very impressed by democracy, and as soon as we came into exile, not even 1.5 year after coming into exile, we had the first elected representatives. Those took oath of office on 2nd September 1960. So even today we celebrate 2nd September as Democracy Day, the first parliament took oath of office in exile. So under very difficult circumstances, logistically it was very difficult those days. You can imagine India those days in the 1960s. You know, they were hardly, in the 70s we had only one car for the whole Central Tibetan Administration. So everybody had to walk up the mountains, down the mountains. And then Tibetans are not located in one place. You know, we had, not many Tibetans have come out of Tibet. Not many people have gone into Tibet. We remained isolated for very long. So many of our people, in fact, very few people could speak other languages. So our people didn't understand any Indian languages. We are not used to Indian way of living, dietary problems, climatic problems, very hot. So many Tibetans died in the process when they were put up in transit camps, and then they were later moved to the foothill hills of Himalayas to work on road construction. That was the only thing we could do, hard labor. Then slowly we were put up in compact communities in different parts of India, wherever the state governments offered land for Tibetan rehabilitation. So even today, we are scattered in 10 different Indian states, from northeast to west to north to south. You know, so it's logistically very difficult. You don't have mobile phones those days. Even landlines were... Even today, you have electricity problems in India. So you can imagine 56 years ago how it was in India. But despite all those problems, we organized ourselves quite well under the leadership of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. So we had our settlements with schools that also teaches Tibetan language, then we have monastic institutions, hospitals, and things like that. So that is the reason why we managed to preserve our identity so far. But now today, we face a lot of challenges again. You know, many of the younger ones from the age 18 to 45 are going out of the settlements. But the monastic education institutions are still very strong with 4,000, 5,000, 3,000 monks. You know. And they are the real backbone of the community. So otherwise, those who are able to give birth and those who are able to provide productive labor are going out of the communities, and only elder generations are remaining there. So we have the now issue of sustainability of the Tibetan compact communities in India, Nepal, and Bhutan. And more are moving out into the Indian cities and towns for jobs, into Europe, to North America, Australia, everywhere. So we are about 150,000 Tibetans in exile. Out of this, about 90,000 are in India, little more than 20,000 in Nepal, few hundreds in Bhutan, between 13 to 15,000 in the whole of Europe, and about 25,000 in North America, little more than 3,000 in Australia, and then few scattered communities in some, altogether some 37 different countries. So when we have elections, we have to have elections in 37 different countries. And I stood for election last time and I lost. Yeah, well, not easy campaigning. You have to go all around. You have to, you know, United States, Europe, Australia, all over India. Yeah, much, much more tougher than American elections. So we have this very small place in Dharamsala. His Holiness decided to over these last 56 years, His Holiness always guided us. Every change has been sometimes to the dislike of the Tibetan population, at the behest of His Holiness. And last time, when he decided in 2011, after every decade he made changes, 2011 he decided to devolve all his political and administrative responsibilities. And I was the Speaker of the Parliament at that time, having to, you know, oversee the whole process of amendments to the Charter. And then we came to U.S. in 2011, July, when there was Kalachakra teaching in Washington, D.C. And we met with the House Foreign Affairs Committee. At that time, the chair of the House was John Boehner. And there was former Speaker Nancy Pelosi and five other heads of chair committees in the meeting. And then His Holiness and Lodi and Losan Singhe, myself, on the other side of the table. So His Holiness in the morning told me, if they ask any questions about democracy, you should answer. If any questions about politics, he pointed to Losan Singhe that he should answer. So one of the lady chair asked this question, how did you go about this change in so short a time, so peacefully? So I was explaining to her that maybe from your perspective, it might seem like it happened so peacefully in so short a time. But for me as Speaker and the House as a whole, we were sandwiched between the strong determination of His Holiness the Dalai Lama and the aspiration of the Tibetan people. And then His Holiness stopped, held my hand, and said, sometimes very stubborn Dalai Lama. Yeah. So he, if he once decides, he decides. You know, he makes it happen, even though people don't like it at that time, but it's for the long-term benefit of the Tibetan people. So we have this democracy, and for that we need these three organs of judiciary, executive, and legislative. We have a judiciary called the Supreme Justice Commission, with justice commissioners. We do spend a little bit of money or resources on this, but Tibetans don't like to go to court. We have this saying in Tibet that you don't go to places where there are fights and arguments. Go to places where they sell oil. At least you get little oil to apply on your head. So those days, oil was a rare commodity in Tibet. So now, of course, oil is in plenty. So in the 22 years of existence of the Supreme Justice Commission, we had less than 22 cases. So you can understand Tibetan mentality. But of course, we don't handle criminal cases. All criminal cases has to go to Indian courts and judiciary and police. Because we live in India, so we have to conform to Indian laws first. But all administrative matters, civil matters within the Tibetan community, we have about 26, one charter and 26 rules and regulations that governs the Tibetans in exile. So all those things we handle. Then we have a parliament. Some of the peculiarities or uniqueness, as you may see it, is that ours is neither presidential nor parliamentary. It's a mix of both. The election of the political leader, as we call that person, some people call that person prime minister, but we don't call it that. So we don't call Tibetan government in exile also. We call it Central Tibetan Administration. So the head of that political, the political leader is directly elected by the people, Tibetans all over the world, except inside Tibet. So since that person is elected directly by the people and he or she nominates his or her own colleagues in the cabinet, these people don't have the right to vote. All the decisions are taken by the 45 parliamentarians. And then we don't have territorial constituencies. We are elected from our provinces like Amdo, Kham and Utang. Each of these three traditional provinces elect 10 members each in India, Nepal and Bhutan, irrespective of the number of electorate. Because there are more people from central Tibet into India because of the proximity of border between India and Tibet, some 3,600 kilometers. So more people could come from central Tibet than Kham and Amdo. The second largest is from their region, third is ours, Amdo. So irrespective of the number, we elect 30 members. And then there's four Buddhist traditions and one pre-Buddhist religion called Pon. Each of them elect two members, 40. That's 30 plus 10, 40. Then Tibetans in North America and South America elect 2 members. Tibetans in Europe and Africa elect 2 members. Tibetans outside India, Nepal, Bhutan in the Asia, Australasia region elect 1 member. So it's 45 in all. And we are the only party-less democracy in the world. We don't have political parties. There are thinkers who have written about party-less democracy, but we are the only practicing party-less democracy. There is one political party called the National Democratic Party of Tibet, but I call them the bonsai party. It's like the Japanese bonsai. You have this tree which has all the characteristics of a tree, but it doesn't grow beyond a point. So its influence is very limited. And there are no other political parties, so the existing political party also doesn't make sense. So we are a party-less. Therefore, we don't have ruling party and opposition party. So when we say party-less, again, some say, oh, it's for the Tibetan parliament, it looks like 45 different political parties, because each individual is a political party. And the good side is that you don't have to follow a political diktat or a political whip. Every single person has the right to use their own conscience, unless you surrender it to somebody else. So these are certain peculiarities or uniqueness, as you may see it. We meet only 2 times a year. Yesterday, the day before, we were saying the American the House and Senate are meeting too many times and it's creating more problems. So we meet less to create less problems. Of course, we don't have that much business also to conduct, unlike independent countries. So the parliament is there to oversee the work of the, maintain accountability of the executive. Then we have the Sikyong, who is the head of the political and administration. Then we have a department for religion and culture with one minister there. We have about 253 monasteries and nunneries in India, Nepal and Bhutan, all established and run by Tibetans. And there are a little more than 41,000 monks and nuns. So out of 150,000 Tibetans, if all 41,000 monks and nuns are Tibetans, we would have a serious population problem. So all these 41,000 monks and nuns are not Tibetans. 58% of these are from the Himalayan region. And 42 are there. And the Tibetan number is also coming down. But that's good because Tibetan Buddhism does not necessarily belong only to Tibetans. It belongs to everybody. So I say if we get to go back to Tibet, our monasteries, the big monasteries like where they come from, are in good hands. We have a lot of Himalayan people to take care of it. So what I mean to say is even though we are refugees, we manage to provide Buddhist education to people from independent countries. So these days now, Anila Kanereshwar, where do you come from? Japanese. So these days, many Japanese groups, Taiwanese groups, Vietnamese groups, Singaporean groups, Thai groups, they all come to Dharamsala to listen to His Holiness. So Tibetan Buddhism is Japan last time when His Holiness visited, Japanese thought they will get tickets very easily. But when the event came up, many Japanese didn't get tickets because there were many Mongolians and Chinese who came to Japan to listen to His Holiness. So, Yeah, so religion, and but we don't interfere in the running of monasteries and nunneries because they have their centuries-old institutionalized management of their monasteries, including curriculum and finance and everything. So we don't interfere, but we do take care of old and informed monks and nuns who need some support. But otherwise, it's the monasteries themselves who conduct everything. Then we have a department for home that takes care of rehabilitation of the Tibetans in the 54 different settlements in India, Nepal, and Bhutan. We have a department for education in which we have been very successful. So we say we are unlike any other refugee community in terms of providing education to the Tibetan in exile. So we have about 72 different schools for some 30,000 students going to schools, and a little more than 2,000-3,000 children in universities. And up to grade 12, we provide all the education. Of course, there are schools run by Indian government, some schools run by Tibetan children's villages where donations come from single individuals, you know, and organizations. So that is, we have a basic education policy also, which brings together both the traditional Tibetan values and modern education, combination of both. Then we have Department for Finance. We sanction about $35 million every year, but 7% comes as direct contribution from the Tibetans themselves, and the rest we still depend on other governments and organizations and individuals. So it's not just one source. If it's just one source, then it becomes very easy for Chinese government to strangle us. Then we don't exist. So Indian government, of course, in the foremost, among the foremost to help the Tibetans in a humanitarian way. And then the U.S. government may be the second. There are projects to, you know, to help the Tibetans inside Tibet, $8 million project. Then for the Tibetans in exile, there is $5 million from the U.S. aid, developmental projects. But now under Trump, we don't know. There's 37% cut in the State Department, the soft power thing. And all that cut is going to happen from U.S. aid. We still don't know how much is that going to impact. Then there's PRM, Population Refugees and Migrations, 2.8 million for newcomers from Tibet, and there's a little more than half a million for Tibetan scholarship. We bring in 11 students every year to learn, study in U.S. So these are broadly the financial support we received. And there's also the Voice of America and Radio Free Asia, which are being supported by the Indian the U.S. government, and which are major tools for communication between Tibetans inside and outside Tibet. Yeah. Then we have a Department for Health. We have both allopathic and Tibetan medicine. Now, Tibetan medicine has been recognized as an alternative medicine by the Indian government alongside Ayurveda, Yunani, Siddha, and other medical practices. And we have a Department for Security, of course, responsible for His Holiness security. Inside India, His Holiness is treated as a state guest. He's on the list of people who can't be searched, and everywhere in India, security is arranged by the Indian government. And likewise, in the United States, they also provide very good security for His Holiness. So it makes our job, my job, very, very, very easy. So I have to just deal with the State Department, and you have the Diplomatic Security Service who will liaise with all the local police and authorities, and everything is done. Some countries we have to hire security. So, and that department also responsible for receiving newcomers from Tibet. Before 2008, we used to receive between 3,000 to 3,500 Tibetans. Now, since the widespread demonstrations in Tibet, participated by people from all walks of life, the number has come down. Last year, it was only 500, 600. So those days were mostly kids who come to India to study. So he also came at a very young age, in 85. He was only 12 at that time, climbing over the Himalayas for 10, 15, 20 days, depending on the route what route you take, and sometimes you get frostbite and, you know, you lose your fingers and toes. Sometimes you get shot, and those don't get reported. Things like that. And then we have this Department for Information and International Relations. So you can imagine how much resource, both human and financial, we have. So we have to reach out to the whole world. And the whole globe is divided into these 12 offices called Offices of Tibet, one among which is our office in Washington, D.C. We have one office in Washington, in Tokyo, in your country. Only three people responsible for Japan, Korea, and some other nations in Southeast Asia. We have one office in Taipei for Taiwan alone. One office in Canberra, responsible from New Zealand to Australia to some parts of Southeast Asia. One office in New Delhi, responsible from Thailand to Middle East. One office in Kathmandu for Nepal. One office in Moscow from Russia, Mongolia to the whole of Central Asia. All these countries, Uzbekistan, Tajikistan, and, you know, Turkey and all those countries. We have one office in Pretoria with only one person. He's the boss, he's the servant, whatever, accountant, everything. And we are not able to go beyond South Africa, and that person is responsible for the whole of Africa. We have one office in Geneva for Southern Europe, one office in Brussels, responsible from, just to give an example, from Portugal to Spain, Belgium, Netherlands, Luxembourg, and the European Union. Only three people. We have one office in London, responsible from Iceland to the whole of UK, to the whole of Scandinavia, four countries. And some countries in Eastern Europe, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, and Poland. Then our office here in Washington, D.C., for U.S. and Canada. And we just opened one new office in Sao Paulo last year, responsible for the whole of Latin America. And there's only one Tibetan there. So sometimes we call him and tell him, please practice your Tibetan. You might forget your Tibetan language also. Well, he doesn't speak Spanish, he doesn't speak Portuguese, and he has nobody to speak Tibetan to, you know. So that's how we try to reach out to the world. Now my office, our office here in Washington, D.C., we are only four people. Our job is to reach out to the White House, to the State Department. The White House, not that many, you know. Right now it's a little more because people in the White House also, they don't know where, what is happening sometimes. So, but we did manage to get some contacts, the China director, the Asia director, the National Security Council, that's our channel normally. So we did manage to build that thing. And we have to State Department, because there is, I don't know whether you're aware or not, but there is a law, an act called the Tibet Policy Act of 2002, the U.S. Tibet Policy Act, which defines U.S. policy on the Tibet issue. So that provides for the State Department and the White House to work on a negotiation between the Chinese authorities and the representatives of His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Then that that act also provides for appointment of a special coordinator for Tibet in the State Department. When it started, it was at the rank of Assistant Secretary, and during the last two administrations, it has been raised to the position of Undersecretary, also responsible for other things like global affairs, democracy, civil society, and all that. So the last special coordinator was Sara Sewell in President Obama's office. And during my 4 months from September to January before she left office, we met three times. She was quite generous in helping me out, you know, with certain things. Now we don't have anybody there. You have only Secretary Rex Tillerson. Tiller's son, so he's a farmer's son. But no deputy, no undersecretary, no assistant, no director. So when those positions are empty, it makes our job more difficult because we can't reach out too much. So we are still waiting as to when these appointments will be made and when this confirmation will be made by the Senate. Sounds like a long process, and some say the Deputy Secretary might come in as early as possible, but Undersecretaries and Assistants might still take time. And now we are asking members at the Hill to write to the department, you know, because Rex Tillerson is coming, is not in in the government. President Trump has not made any statements on Tibet or religious freedom or human rights, so we don't know what he thinks. But sometimes it looks like it doesn't matter what he thinks, because he says some things and goes back on his words the next day. You know? And Rex Tillerson was in China a few days ago, so today I'm going back to D.C. and tomorrow, day after, we have 2 days of Tibet lobby days organized by International Campaign for Tibet, which they do every year. So Tibet supporters and Tibetans come from different states to Washington, D.C. to meet with their representatives, meet with their senators, and tell them about some ask. So in future, if you want to join from this state, from the state of North Carolina, or when we, as I mentioned before, when we have bills being moved there, if you can write and call up, even here you can, if you can ask your representative to raise the issue of Tibet, you know, help, assist, that is something that you can really do and really helps us, because the members are very, very concerned about their constituents. So all they care is they want to win the next election, and you have the vote. So we keep telling that to the American Tibetans also, Tibetan Americans, that now you have the right to vote. So you also have the right to tell your representative what you want your representative to do for Tibet. So our job also, at the Hill, we work very closely with International Campaign for Tibet. And now when I'm not moving around, then we have a lot of meetings at the Hill with the staffs and members and all that. Last month, Richard Gere was there up there, and he's a very good supporter, very committed supporter. So in 2 days, we met 8 congressmen and women and 6 senators, all senior ones, in 2 days. So we were running like one meeting after another. So these efforts are going on. Fortunately, because of His Holiness' leadership and support from the general American public, we enjoy good support from both the House and the Senate, and also from the Republicans and the Democrats. But unfortunately, the senior Republicans that we have been in touch over the years don't have too good a relation with the transition team of the Trump government. So there we had to work a little harder to get around, you know. Then we have, I mentioned, 25,000 Tibetans in North America, and they are scattered in some 32 different states. So this is my 19th state in 6 months. So I've been moving from Vancouver, BC, Seattle, Portland, Wisconsin, Chicago, Michigan, Minneapolis, Colorado, Santa Fe, Albuquerque, Ithaca, Amherst, Boston, Connecticut, New York, New Jersey, yesterday in Atlanta, here, day before yesterday in Atlanta, and here now in North Carolina. Now last night we decided to make the Tibetan organization a little more formalized. Now we have a new president here in the form of, this is Sangula, and some other members are also here last night. We had this very formal thing. You might see their pictures on our website, you know. And then next month I'm going to Houston. We also meet with all the Indian consulates to make sure that we have good relations with them. And there is a small community in Austin. So once we have all the Tibetan communities together like this, then we will reach out to other communities, Vietnamese, you know, other Buddhist communities, see how much we can do things, you know. So then we also make it a point to visit all the Buddhist centers. So this is one of the things I want to understand, how Buddhist centers are organized, what kind of facilities they have, whether there are opportunities for us to work together in future, not only for you as disciples, but also for the Tibetan community. to organize summer camps or things like that, you know. And this is that brings us here today. And this also provided, I think, Buddhist centers are playing a very important role in reaching out to non-Tibetans like you. And these centers are now becoming full of energy, not just from a religious perspective, but His Holiness says, if you are really concerned about the Tibetan Buddhist culture, then also help the Tibetans inside Tibet, because they are part of our culture, you know. So whatever way, but there's no force. If you are interested only in Buddhist religion and your own self-enlightenment, you're most welcome to go straight. But on the way, if you think, okay, we can help this, we can do this, and then, you know, take step by step, you're most welcome to do that. And I think I was told that you're doing a wonderful job. So we also have to reach out to Chinese. Four people, imagine, poor four of us, we have to keep running, you know. So we have to, this is one of His Holiness' vision, that the Chinese people are also suffering like us. So they are also human being. Everybody is looking for happiness. So we reach out to the Chinese intellectuals, writers, professors. They write about Tibet, the commitments of His Holiness, the middle way approach of His Holiness. So today we are not seeking independence. We are seeking autonomy under the middle way approach from China. And we quote from the Chinese constitution and the law on national regional autonomy as to what the law of the China provides for national minorities. So they have no answer. So that's why they are saying, oh, Dalai Lama is asking for covert independence or semi-independence. I don't know who they are trying to fool. Dalai Lama is a splittist, separatist. His Holiness always says, I'm not asking for independence, I'm asking for autonomy. So, obviously, they are trying to fool the Chinese inside China, not make them know what the real truth is. You know, so we try to reach out to the Chinese and explain our position. Because the reality is that the solution to Tibet, or for Tibet, can come only by dealing with China. America will not fight for us, NATO will not fight for us, India cannot fight for us. We don't want violence also. You know. So keeping that reality in mind, what His Holiness says, the common sense part of the Chinese leadership is missing. So if that is brought back, I'm sure we can find a solution, a negotiated, mutually beneficial solution for the Tibet. Then to conclude, just a little story. Who is the first Tibetan Columbus? Any ideas? When Tibet was independent, we sent a trade delegation to North America, to U.S., in 1947. So Tsipin Shagapa and his delegates were the first Tibetans to step on American soil, if I'm not wrong. If I find history before that, I'll come back to you and let you know. Because another Mongolian told me that the Mongols tried to build diplomatic relations with the United States in 1911. And the person dealing with the United States government was the Mongolian Lama, equivalent to the Dalai Lama for Tibet. They have this Kyaga Jejun Thamba. But that Lama happened to be born in Tibet. So he was a Tibetan Mongolian Lama. You know. So that's the complex thing. And how did Tibetan Buddhism came to U.S.? Again, it was not a Tibetan monk. It was a Mongol monk who studied Tibetan Buddhism called Sogo Geshe Wangyal. Yeah? He came in 1954 to U.S. So all these people, Bob Thurman, Jeffrey Hopkins, and many of them are all disciples of Sogo Geshe Wangyal, the famous Buddhist scholars, of non-Tibetan Buddhist scholars. Then late 50s, His Holiness' elder brother, Dr. Rinpoche, came. You know, we had a guerrilla warfare training. The non-violent Tibetans being trained in guerrilla warfare by CIA in Colorado in the early 60s. And some of the Tibetans were also sent to Cornell University to study accounts and management at that time, in the 60s. And we sent, His Holiness sent Liu Xiaor in 1963 to start this office, the Office of Tibet. So at that time in New York, mostly to work with the United Nations. Then it was registered as a foreign agent in 1964. So we have been, this office has been in existence from 1964, more than 52 years now, I think. Then we sent the first group of Tibetans, a group of Tibetans, six Tibetans. Can you imagine where in U.S.? In Maine. As lumberjacks. Working for a paper company. So initially I think they were not treated fairly, you know. The paper company asked them to cut the smaller trees, whereas they gave the bigger trees to the Canadian lumberjacks. So Tibetans cutting seven trees, and Canadian cutting one tree, same pay. Because they measure the diameter to pay, you know. So later they protested and they got fair play a little bit of. And that project was successful, so we sent another 21 Tibetans to Maine. And then there was some problem, you know, after, of course, a few years of working, and these Tibetans stayed in the forest. They never went out of Maine, coming from India. So the paper company owner thought that even if I say, ask them to go, because they were asking for a pay raise, and the owners were not raising it, and they said, okay, you don't need to fulfill the contract, you know, if you want to, you can leave. And majority of the Tibetans left, and there were no GPS. They lost their way and came back. You know, so today they are scattered in, you know, D.C., Boston, Seattle, Portland. So these are the elder generations of Tibetans who came to the United States. And then we moved about 240 Tibetans to Canada in 1971. Now since then, by 87, I think we were only about 450 Tibetans in the whole of the United States. Then there was this 1,000 Tibetans to move to U.S. in the early 90s, and it became 2,000, 3,000, and today it's more than 25. But we still don't have the exact number. If you ask the Tibetans in New York, New Jersey, which is supposed to be the biggest community in North America, some say 6,000, some say 8,000, some say 10,000, some say 12,000. So between 6 to 12, there's 100% difference. Yeah. So I'm trying to get some numbers now. So we are requesting the community here also to supply us with a number, however big or small the community is. At least we need some numbers. So this is the story. So how is it listening to the story? Yeah. So any questions before I leave North Carolina? Actually, the mayor and some people here, Dan, and you know, our old friends, Kwame Nkrumah, Dr. Brown and Dr. Walken and John Culkin, the mayor and some other people, some influential people in North Carolina are working towards bringing His Holiness here. And I was told, Dr. Dan said, I've been trying this for the last 20 years and not successful. Dr. Brown, Dan Brown. So I don't know. Well, the request is there, but His Holiness is now 82, getting older, and a lot more commitments. His knee is not very well. Otherwise, all other parts of his body is fine. Particularly his brain is working very, very sharp. So let us hope that His Holiness gets to come here once, you know. Yeah, please.
First, thank you very much for being here and sharing so much information with us. Early on, you mentioned the translations, the new translations that are going to occur. Do you have a timetable for that into English? You mentioned the scientific...
The English version should come as soon as possible. It should be. I don't know exactly when, but I'm sure Gisela can... both Gishlas can ask, and whenever it's out, we can ask them to have access for you for the center here and or the library. I don't know how many copies will be printed in the first place, but among all other translations, including German, Spanish, Japanese, Chinese, and all that, English version should come out first. Yeah, there are two books. No, please.
Great, thank you for coming. Many of us live in an area where David Price is our representative. Does that name sound familiar to you? Does he work with your committee?
that right now what we are trying to, it's not possible for us to meet all the 500 plus House members and senators. So we try to focus on the members of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, House Foreign Affairs Committee, Tom Lantos Human Rights Committee, Congressional Executive Commission on China, and the Appropriations Committee. So we try to, right now we try to focus on these five. But the people, your representatives, you know, if you tell us this is our representative, he would be willing to meet us, then we'll definitely approach their office and we'll go there and meet them. Or you can ask the Tibetans here, when he is here on constituent job work, to go and meet him here and talk about the Tibet issue. So at both level, we have to work. Yeah.
Mm. My question is, the Dalai Lama's reincarnation, it's well known that, or I don't know, that he was murdered as a child or he disappeared. What happens...
That is Panchen Lama.
Yes.
Yeah.
What happens to... Where is the identity centered around if something happens to His Holiness Dalai Lama?
No, I also sometimes jokingly say, let us see whether the Dalai Lama outlives the Communist Party or the Communist Party outlives the Dalai Lama. His Holiness believes that he will live up to 100, but he doesn't want to be a cabbage at the same time. You know, he wants to be useful when he is living. So let us see where that takes us. Yeah, coming to the question, His Holiness made it very clear that if there has to be a reincarnation of the 14th, and if there will be a 15th, then he will be born in a free world, not in China, definitely. So, but again, the question, of course, when Nancy Pelosi and the congressional delegation that went to Tibet last year, I think most of the talks were centered around the reincarnation of the 14th Dalai Lama. So, what makes the Chinese communist leaders mindful is Dalai Lama's reincarnation. So they're so worried, in a sense. So what I can tell you right now is that the legacy of Dalai Lama, this 14th Dalai Lama, has extended way beyond Tibetans inside and outside Tibet. So you have, if you say only the Tibetans will be responsible for the reincarnation of the 14th Dalai Lama, then the Mongols will rise up, the Kalmyks and Buryats and Tuvas will also say, are we not followers of Tibetan Buddhism, or are we not followers of Dalai Lama? And now you have more Japanese, Taiwanese, you know, Vietnamese, Singaporeans, Thai people all coming to listen to His Holiness. And then there are also a lot of friends in the West, in the free world, who are concerned about His Holiness, connected with His Holiness in some way or the other. So there will definitely be a process in place. What His Holiness clarified later is that in his 11 September 2011 statement on reincarnation, is that by the time he reaches the age of the first Dalai Lama, who lived the longest, that was 84 years old. So by the time he reaches the age of the first Dalai Lama, then he will make a decision on the reincarnation. So that is 2 years from now. So what I understand is that there will be a committee formed to set a process in motion, most probably an opinion poll with yes and no, that whether you want a reincarnation of the 14th or not. If the majority says we don't want reincarnation of the 14th, then Dalai Lama will make a statement to the effect that he will be the last Dalai Lama. But if the majority says we need a 15th, then there will be other set of processes in motion, which will involve high lamas, you know. And then following that, I'm sure His Holiness will leave very definitive pointers as to where he will be born. Yeah. Are my answers clear enough? Yeah? Okay. Yeah. If I confuse you, then my job becomes useless.
Hi, thanks for coming. I have a question about in China, the Tibet, of course they have the one child policy for so many years. now I believe it's two children, in Tibet, within the Tibet community, were they restricted to the one-child policy over the years? And, well, what's the family size like there?
The policy is the same, but then restriction in Tibet is less. I think some families are smart enough to give birth to their child in the remote mountain areas, so the Chinese authorities don't even know a child is born or not. Yeah. So I think the family size is a little more than what a normal Chinese family size is. Some, I think, there may be very few families with 3-4 children. But otherwise, 2 children are quite normal, not unlike China. For the Chinese civil servants, it's one child. But when they work in Tibet, they have some incentives, including having one extra child or more pay, or when they go back, also better promotion. Those are there. But the family size, I think, a little more flexible than in China. Yeah. Please, here. Cameron.
So you were saying that the next Dalai Lama, if there is going to be another one, will be born probably somewhere else.
Not inside China.
Exactly, not inside China. Could this be a woman?
It could be you, who knows, for all that matter.
Good, that was my first question.
His Holiness has said it could be, so who knows. That I'm not clairvoyant, so I can't tell you whether it'll be a man or a woman, but traditionally it has been men. Mm-hmm. And if there's a huge revolution in reincarnation, it could be a woman, who knows.
Good, I'll take that into consideration.
Women power.
Absolutely. That's why I asked. The second question is, it is very difficult to keep one's culture when you're away from home.
Right.
And I see that this is happening to the Tibetans, where they are spread all over the world. Mm. So how successful have you been, do you think, in keeping those in that culture intact to a certain extent at least, especially with the younger generation and with so much different distractions that they have to go astray, so to speak?
Yesterday also we were talking, he was also mentioning of what His Holiness said about Tibetan Buddhist culture. So Tibetan Buddhist culture is not so much about the dress that you wear, but it's more here.
Mm-hmm.
So in that sense, I think it's spreading more than the Tibetans, and which is very much alive, and that's good for humanity.
So, another third question.
Yeah, sure. Any number of questions.
Any number. you mentioned several ways in which the Tibetans can be helped. My suggestion is that maybe if you write down something, specifically for people, say, listen, this is what you can do. Call this number or do whatever. It's more, people tend to forget. But if you have a paper, you have something, a note, this might help us a little bit more. That's just a suggestion.
If you want to make financial contributions, you always have the center to do that. The center is doing a lot of good work. The whole network of centers that Lama Sabha is running, it's doing a very good job. So center also needs financial support. And I was told that the Serame Kembo Abbot also came last time and appealed for some fund for building there some construction work. And Sarah and you helped. That's also good. And if you want to, in a political way, if you want to help Tibet, there is this blue book for non-Tibetans who wants to make whatever contribution you want to the Central Tibetan Administration in Dharamsala. It goes directly there. And then you can also become members of International Campaign for Tibet, based in Washington, D.C. They are a global network of supporters, the largest network, largest non-governmental organization that supports the Tibet issue. We work very closely with them in Washington, D.C. to reach out to the Hill. They have offices in Amsterdam, Berlin, and Brussels. They might work with Australia also, so they also need support. And you can support individuals, students, families, you know, like one student in DCB for 1 month, I don't know, $30-$40, which is not so much here, but can support one child education in Dharamsala. So these are certain things where you don't need to move your body too much, but touch your pocket a little bit, or maybe ask your bank, okay, send so much money for this account, you know.
Very good. Thank you.
Any other? Yeah. I'm not forcing questions on you. I'm just asking. Okay, last question.
It's not really a question so much, but it's a comment. I'm a retired school teacher, and I work with international students. I had a student from China, and I was speaking to the class about Tibet and what's going on in Tibet. She had no idea what I was talking about. She had no idea of their place being called Tibet. And so for me, that was really shocking. And you know, I think what's really going on in Tibet now is cultural genocide.
Right.
And this happens to Native Americans. It happened to African Americans during slavery and so forth, you know. And that really, really worries me. Once we forget history, there's no recourse that we have.
Right. Yeah. So that's the reason why we try to reach to Chinese. Since too much propaganda is fed by the Communist China, you know, whether it's to do with Tibet or Uyghur or elsewhere, including South China Sea. If you ask ordinary Chinese, they will say, oh, South China has always been part of China, which never was, you know. Because of these propagandist thing, and also the fact that if the Chinese don't know about Tibet, that means Tibet was never part of China in the first place. If they know Tibet is part of China, then they should know Tibet is part of China, or they should have heard about Tibet. But then maybe this is, of course, China is 1 billion people, 1.4 billion people, so we can't expect all Chinese to know, because they don't know many. Many Chinese may not have gone out of their own towns, you know. But more and more Chinese are paying a lot more attention to Tibet and Tibetan Buddhism. So since you don't have international tourists in Tibet, most of the tourists are from China. So some just come as curiosity. They come in groups in buses, and they go see Potala and some places, take pictures with Tibetans in colorful dresses and go back. But some are staying a little more longer to understand what Tibetan culture is, what Tibetan Buddhism is. And many Tibetan monks are also going to China. Not necessarily all good monks. There are also bad monks also who just make money without even the right qualification of, you know, teaching. Not like Gishis here, you know. So there's many opportunities also, many opportunities. So those cultural exchanges are happening more than before. But we have to watch. We are talking about 300, 400 million Chinese Buddhists. And what His Holiness really believes is that we can really help these people who have been deprived of culture. And that's why I was making this joke yesterday. Tibetans say, "Oh, mani peme, oh, mani peme." In China these days, you know, since communism came, there was a vacuum in culture. And now resurgence, of course, people are making money. And then there will be a resurgence in looking for culture, and then maybe more political power eventually. But today, the new mantra is Om Mani Mani, More Money, Come Soon Swaha. So you have to also the Om Mani Mani, More Money, Come Soon Swaha in China. Okay, with that, I hope more money comes to you and you can help others more. Along with this.
On behalf of all the members of Kadampa Center, Mr. Sering, I'd like to thank you very much for being so generous with your time and coming and sharing with us this morning. And we thank you for all the wonderful work you're doing, and we pray for the success of His Holiness's efforts and everything that you're working for. And we invite you to come back soon.
You guys come back soon.
If I come back too often, you'll get bored.
Thank you so much.
Okay, is that it?
That's it.
Yeah.